I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In a country where almost everyone comes from somewhere else, the question of what constitutes home is not always easy to answer. In Vartan Gregorian's new autobiography, The Road to Home, he writes that it took years for him to realize that his home was no longer Iran, where he was born, or Beirut, where he was educated, or even Stanford University, where he zoomed through college in 2 years and then obtained a Ph.D. Home was not even the universities where he lived much of his professional life, first as a professor in Texas, then a dean at UPenn, and finally a president at Brown University. It wasn't until he went to New York City, where he assumed the presidency of the New York Public Library and then went on to head the Carnegie Corporation, that Gregorian says he found, finally, a place to call home. Gregorian's life story is more than the Horatio Alger-like rise of a poor Armenian boy from Tabriz who grew up to fame and influence in America. It's also the tale of an immigrant's insatiable thirst for knowledge, the intellect and ambition that fueled him, and the people who helped along the way. Connection listeners, is home the place of your birth or a location of your choosing, the place that helped you become who you are? What is it that makes us feel more at home in one place than another? And does home have a special resonance when the rest of the world feels a little less secure? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Vartan Gregorian joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
I've already given listeners a little bit about your history, but deliberately did not mention yet on this day after Mother's Day the major influence in your life, someone who pops up over and over again at key moments, and that was your grandmother, who was both mother and grandmother to you. Describe her for me.
Well, my mother died when I was 6.5 years old. While she was alive, we called my grandmother Mother and my grandfather Father. So I never called my mother as Mother. And I was told that my mother went to America. She was so beautiful, so young, 22 that she died, that I dreamt that she was far away place. So my grandmother replaced my mother. My father was an absentee father. It's my grandmother who brought me up and my sister. She was an illiterate woman, peasant, but she was one of the wisest people who gave me an education, discipline, as well as my first moral lessons in life. First time I stole something, 10 cents worth, she punished me so hard. As I was crying, she was crying. And I thought that was the ultimate sign of love. She said, those who steal an egg will be able to steal a horse. So the amount did not matter. First time I used the newly acquired Turkish cuss words, she washed my mouth with soap, said, your mouth will always be clean. And she also told me that of all the things that I should do in life, I must be very careful not to trade my dignity. That's the only commodity that one has that should not be traded. It's the only thing one has in life, one's name, one's reputation, and one's character.
You wrote down some of those explicit lessons. I wonder if you'd read an excerpt from the book.
My grandmother admonished me about the 7 deadly sins when I was 12. I understood about pride, anger, and sloth. I had no notion of covetousness, lust, or gluttony. Envy impressed me most because I was told it was a bottomless pit. Certain virtues were hard to understand until later in life, such as humility, generosity, restraint, moderation, forgiveness, charity. Her bottomless stores of sayings were to help guide us through life. These are some that have stayed with me throughout these years. The stomach, for example, is an oven. If there is adequate fuel in it, don't overburden it. You don't build a reputation or make a name for yourself on what you're going to do. An unkind word is like a thrown stone. It cannot be called back. The reason you have a house with walls is to keep the family news inside. Don't make a private matter a public one. Don't insult a crocodile before you cross a river. Those who know much don't talk too much. good advice, like good medicine, is hard to swallow. My grandmother instilled in me, as I indicated, at an early age, the notions of reputation, honor, and dignity. I learned from her, and at school as well, how to distinguish between chakatagir, meaning fate, kismet, or what is written on your forehead, and nikaragir, meaning character, or what is imprinted in you. Over the first, I was told, we have no control. But in the case of nikaragir, or character, we're fully responsible and accountable.
And those are some life lessons that you found later along your path.
Absolutely.
It's interesting, too, that in addition to being wise, she was also a very fierce person. You tell the story about how one day she noticed bruises on your arms, and she marched both of you to confront the school principal.
Well, she told me, if you fight with your friends, don't bother me. But if a grown-up hits you, let me know. I had hit accidentally, I thought, which was not the case, evidently, the school principal with a snowball. It hit his face. I was punished very harshly. At the time in Iran, corporal punishment was an accepted reality. I was slapped, whipped, and came home with bruises. And I told my grandmother, "So what happened? Somebody hit me, a grown-up. So take me to him." So I did. As we walked into school, the principal was pacing up and down, and my grandmother approached him, said, "Have you fed this boy?" "No." "Have you taken care of?" "No." And as he was trying to explain, my grandmother slapped him once or twice, and he said, "I'm a modir," which means I'm a principal. My grandmother pretended did not know what modir meant, and he used an obscenity for the only once I have heard the obscenity. "I don't care who you are," and we went home. There was a great scandal. They want to expel me from school and so forth, but people intervened that I was a good student, and I was an orphan, so I got away with it.
It was also her vote in a family meeting that allowed you to leave the country and start your life's journey, and that could not have been an easy permission for her to give, and particularly at that time in her life.
You're absolutely right. My grandmother had 7 children and had lost all of them. And I was the last, my sister and I were the last survivors in the family. She thought it was a curse to survive one's children, outlive one's children. So as a result, she was very protective of me. And when I decided to leave home, it's a long story, to go to Beirut to study, my father and relatives gathered to try to convince me not to go. I had already met the first challenge. I obtained passport at age 14 all by myself. And that's another story. However, they thought my grandmother would not let me go. And there was a big family gathering when they told her my grandmother needs me, I should not leave, and they'll take care of my education in Iran.
But she was the last barrier, right? She could have easily said no.
And they expected her to say no. So she told me, go, my son, and become a man. And as she did, I cried and she cried. So everybody was astonished.
There was another time later in your life, much later in your life, you were in the middle of a meeting which was very emotionally charged, and you were able to stay in control. I mean, it sounds as if it's the kind of meeting where you really wanted to stand up and start screaming and throwing things. But you sat and you wrote her name over and over in Armenian. How did that help steady you?
Well, whenever I have been in crisis, the only steadying power I have is my grandmother. Because she was a stoic, she bore losses of all the children and all the difficulties of life with great courage. And in order to remain calm, all I have to do is write her name in Armenian. And then I said, I am not going to disappoint you. I'm not going to be losing my temper. I'm going to be the best in my best behavior. And that works. Until now, twice, 3 times, it has worked in my life.
And is she also the person who inspired your love of learning, or was that really something that came from within you?
No, she is the one, and my teachers, along with my teachers. She was very apologetic, defensive, that she was illiterate. Even though among Armenians, co-education always has been since 19th century for women and men a reality. Her middle name was Mirzayan, which means coming from the family of scribes. But
she took great pride in.
But at the same time, she made sure that her children will go to school. So my mother finished high school, and my father had finished American high school in Tabriz. And so she took great pride, and she said, whatever you do, the only durable thing you have is knowledge, and you have to learn. So her encouragement was doubled by encouragement of my teachers, because there was nothing to do. The only escape valve I had was knowledge and education. And only fantasy I had in a poor city, poor family, was reading. Reading is the only thing that allowed me to transcend the realities of my limitations, creating a new fantasy land, land of possibilities, realm of possibilities.
It's been described elsewhere as reading to the power, or has the power of intoxication, because it takes you completely from where you are to somewhere else entirely.
Absolutely. I almost got drunk by reading, because I lived the lives of all the protagonists, all the novels I read. And this was fascinating. It did not cost much at all, just to read.
You also write about learning in the Iranian school system about adab. What is that, and how has that influenced you?
Well, adab is a Persian, classical Persian word, which is more than education. It's culture, how to be educated and cultured. But that's not enough. How to have comportment, savoir-faire, manners, all of this, etiquette, all of this goes under one name, adab. That you are a complete person because you received education, culture. Also, you have known how to behave, how to appreciate, how to be generous, how to be polite, how to have manners, good manners, and all of this under that one word. So when they say, by adab, he has adab, he has comportment, he has knowledge, all of it bound to one word.
But you clearly had to have something even more than that. It takes more than charm and good manners to make one's way through life in the way that you have.
Well, it requires desire, imagination, drive, but also curiosity. Of all the things, I think most important thing is curiosity. If you're curious, you will learn. If you learn, then some things happen to you. And also teachers, naturally. Teachers are the ones who find. The best attribute I can tell about teachers is when they find talents that you don't know you have. They detect talents in you that you don't know you possess. They're like Geiger counters. They find in each individual something.
We're going to pick up the story after we take a break about what happened when you became a teacher in the United States. Connection listeners, we're talking this hour with Vartan Gregorian about books and home and whether the road to home leads away from or back to the place where you were born. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialists. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. Also by The MathWorks. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. My guest is Vartan Gregorian, president of the Carnegie Foundation of New York and author of a new autobiography called The Road to Home. He says that unlike many immigrants, he didn't feel homesickness for the old country because life for him had been so hard there. Connection listeners, we're talking about the road to home for all of us. Is home really where you came from or where you're going? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And speaking of where you're going, I want to get to your time in the United States. But first, there's one more, I thought, fascinating story from the book that I want you to tell. And that was your very interesting approach to discipline. You were at the Armenian College in Beirut. You were appointed as an assistant to the director of the boarding house there at the college, and one morning your young charges snuck out on you when you were going to church and had asked them if they wanted to go, and they said no.
I gave them choice to go to movies or to church. They did not accept either of them. They said they want to sleep or rest. And then when I came back early, they'd all gone. They'd gone to their movie, their choice of the movie, and a movie house. And then I sat in front of the gate under the tree as they rushed in two cabs coming back. They saw me and they froze.
I'm sure.
And they expect me to shout or say anything. I did not say a word. They stood in front of me for 10 minutes, and one by one they left. And I thought that was the best discipline and the best lesson, that therefore, following my grandmother's advice, the silence sometimes has more impact than words.
Well, I'm presuming that they never did it again, but you refer to your grandmother. Was that really what made you respond in the way in which you did? You certainly could have easily berated them. You could have even hit them because you had been hit over time for various infractions.
Well, I learned how not to hit. But I also had read the life of Pestalozzi, the Swiss educator, who educated people in the harshest possible conditions. And they beat him up. When he died, they had all become men, educated and good citizens. So the romantic notion, and I was trying this discipline, and it worked. And I did not try again the same thing. I used words the second time, but it never happened, in their case at least.
When you came to the United States to study, you had prepared a long explanation for anyone who asked about the history of the Armenian people, obviously a heritage you were very proud of, but they didn't ask. I mean, were you surprised and disappointed that apparently nobody in America really cared all that much about who you were and where you came from and the glorious history of the Armenian people?
Well, they asked. I said, I'm from Iran. They said, is it in Ethiopia? I said, no. Do I look Ethiopian? And the only thing they knew about Armenians were starving Armenians, or the cliché, or football players at Stanford at the time when I came. They were Manukyan brothers who were called Shish Kebab Team. And then, of course, there was Arlene Francis and Ruben Mamoulian and William Saroyan. But they had no notion of it. So I had prepared a statement to say, as long as somebody asked me, but nobody asked me, that Armenians came first to the United States, 17th century, before, right along the time of pilgrims. They came as part of British colonial power. And then they brought silkworm to Virginia in 17th, 18th century. And then in different waves, they came to the United States, thanks to American missionaries who had educated some of them in the Ottoman Empire. Some of them came to study to become doctors and so forth. I even found out there were Armenian doctors and nurses, male nurses and so forth, during American Civil War on the Federal Union side, and who were the first Armenians, went to which college and so forth. So that made all of this, I learned by heart, but I had no chance to tell. So I wrote in my book.
You finally got to deliver the speech.
Finally got the opportunity to tell about the fact that they're an old part of America.
Well, at least you eventually made use of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of your account of your early years at Stanford seems to be from the perception of the outsider looking in and really kind of puzzling mm-hmm. about many aspects of American society. And I'm wondering whether, to some extent, that quality helped you to succeed, because you had to try harder, work longer, exert yourself more, you know, be more diligent, be more charming.
Well, what I found out as part of my Americanization, and that's one of the things all the foreigners, all the immigrants have faced, that work is not, does not have, work has dignity in America, as long as it's a means leading somewhere. Every student who worked, American student, bragged about it. They were working in the restaurant, they were working in the dormitory, and so forth. So that was one thing I learned. So much so, when President Ayub Khan came to from Pakistan, came to the United States, he said, if people from Indian subcontinent, when they come to Palo Alto, they carry their own suitcase from the train to the street to the car, if you teach them that, that will be the greatest revolution. So that impressed me very much. And second, I learned another thing about Stanford, that I was both outsider and insider. I saw everything in perspective. I did not take anything for granted. And I was spoiled in many ways. All my professors treated me as somebody worthwhile that deserves their attention. I have been in the home of all my professors, either for dinner or lunch or holidays and so forth. All of them adopted me. As a matter of fact, I was trying to find a title for my book. I initially thought I should use With the Kindness of Strangers, with all due credit to Tennessee Williams and Blanche DuBois and so forth, because without them, without total strangers, I would never have succeeded either at Stanford or in America. As a matter of fact, my first episode of meeting generosity of Americans was at the Idlewild, now JFK, when I lost my ticket to San Francisco. I was so upset. Here it is. I'm a foreign land. So clumsy, I lose my ticket. And I said, what can I do? They said, well, first you have to advertise. 6 months later, if nobody cashes in, you can apply for refund. I said, you don't understand. I have to be there. I was
in 2 days or something,
in 2 days.
Right?
I was crying. I was so angry at myself, disgusted at myself. This man, TWA ticket official said, I've never done this in my life. I'm going to do something which I've never done. I'm going to stamp your empty envelope, New York to San Francisco. Don't get out of the plane anyplace. So 18 hours or more, New York, Kansas City, Chicago, Kansas City, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. I stayed in the plane. I never even asked the name of the person. I was so grateful and so upset at myself. But that was a generosity, because when I first came to New York, I wrote home that I feel like an ant. If somebody steps on me, they don't even bother clean. I'm an anonymous ant. But I found that even in the megapolis, which New York is, there's one gentle person who, for solidarity, kindness, pity, whatever motivated him, helped me. That's been my life story at Stanford and other places. Work is fine, but also earning the trust of others and being worthy of their trust and worthy of their help. As a matter of fact, I shocked some people. I said, I've never applied for a job. It's always my professors, my mentors, and others have put my forward, my candidacy, and pushed me forward. At Stanford, I was also older when I came to Stanford, because changing various schools from Armenian to Persian to Turkish to Russian, back to Persian, so forth, then Lebanon and so forth, I lost 3-4 years. So when I came to Stanford, I was 21, as freshman. I wore a necktie, sat in the back, in pretending that I was a graduate student. So I was mature also in many ways. As a result, I learned more.
We have one of your former students who wants to speak to you.
Oh.
Let's go to our phone lines and hear from Adriana. Hi, Adriana. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. President Gregorian, it's truly a pleasure to finally have a chance to thank you. I'm an immigrant from Mexico, and I was an employee at Brown in 1992-94 with no plans to pursue higher education. And it was very much having heard snippets here and there about your life story and just being in the environment that you created at Brown that really inspired me to sort of wake up my mind and decide to pursue a PhD. And I did so in the art history department there and was wonderfully supported, in part because I think of the culture you created at Brown that was welcoming to people such as myself. And I now have a PhD, and I teach. I'm an assistant professor here in Boston.
Wonderful.
And I just wanted to say thank you so much, because you truly have been an inspiration to both me and my brother, who also was a Brown student.
Oh, I'm so delighted to hear that. As a matter of fact, one of the things I was discussing yesterday, that the only way I try to repay my debt to America as an immigrant, to make possible for every other American that I came in contact with to facilitate their education. As a matter of fact, I have taught in my career some 12,000-13,000 students, and it's wonderful to see them in positions, including you now, way up there on the top of American academic life. So I'm delighted and rejoiced.
Thank you. Well, I hope in my small way I can continue the generosity that you bestowed on others. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, congratulations, Adriana. And this was not a setup. We did not plan this in advance, but it was truly wonderful to hear from her. You know, for all of your appreciation of America, though, it really took you a long time to become a citizen, which seems interesting given that here you were in the classroom day after day teaching democracy and justice and the American values and the American ideals.
Well, what happened was that Iran does not recognize naturalization. And my grandmother was my anchor in life, and my sister and family, all of them were there. And so I kept my Iranian citizenship while the rest of my family were Americans, my wife, my children. But in 1976, something happened. I saw the tall ships, celebration of bicentennial, and I felt lousy that here I am in Pennsylvania, and I'm not a citizen. So I applied for citizenship, and then I became citizen, and it was scary for me to the whole ceremony, because the person who examined me for citizenship was a Penn graduate who was dressed to kill with his necktie, Penn colors, and so forth. And he asked me about everything I did, answered well. And he asked me how many amendments there are in the Constitution. I said, 29. My goodness, said, that's wrong. I said, well, I was counting, the equal rights amendment. So, well, it's not passed yet. So he relaxed. I was very fast. And then Judge Lou Pollack, who was a federal judge and former dean of law school, swore me in. But it was, I entered nonchalantly, but the moment I became, ceremony started, it was, I was so moved as if I was marrying again. It was like a marriage, this time not to a person, but to a country, to whole United States of America, in the presence of my children, my friends, and so who were witness. And I have gave a speech on that occasion of what I think America is for me, what it stands for, and I published that in the book also, the speech.
And you must have been thinking about your grandmother at that moment.
I did, because my grandmother by then had died, and I had no more links. I did not come to the United States as an immigrant, so I did not have clarity of American dream and so forth. For me, what I appreciate in America, that I came as a subject. I became a citizen. Of all the rights America privileged had, I valued most of all freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of education, equal opportunity. Others may like money and so forth, but I did not think of America as economic opportunity place, but rather as potentiality place. Also, the only place, if I may say so, that Gabriel Garcia Marquez in Love in the Time of Cholera has one of the characters saying that people are not born once and for all when their mothers give birth to themselves, to them, but throughout their lives, they're able to reinvent themselves, to give rebirth. So I found that America is one of those countries you can give constant rebirth to yourself.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-423-8255. What point was it then? You became a citizen in 76.
At 79.
Sorry, 79. At what point then did you realize that America, and in fact New York, really was your home now?
On September 11th, when the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center, at that very time I landed in Michigan, Ann Arbor, Detroit. I was going to give a lecture at the University of Michigan on academic freedom. I was picked at the airport, and they told me a plane had hit the World Trade Center. I said they should ban those Cessnas. They're dangerous. Well, suddenly we learned that what it was. University of Michigan canceled all the classes, all the activities, but they insisted that I should give that speech symbolically on academic freedom, the place of the importance of the university. Having given that, trying to return, I was driven to Toledo, took the train. It took 20 hours for me to come, 22, more than, because the train stopped every place to pick up the mail. And as I was coming to New York, frightened what has happened to my wife, my family, my children, my city, suddenly dawned on me that after all the jobs I have held in San Francisco, in Texas, in Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and that suddenly I have reached home, because I was thinking of loss of my home, my family, that for the first time I had a family, in a sense. I no longer had to look back in the past. I had a home. and my home was New York.
And it's interesting, too, because throughout the book, as you describe the various places where you lived and taught, it sounds as if you loved pretty much every place you ever had been.
I loved each place and each job I have had. But I never thought till 9/11 that all of that might disappear. And when you're put in a crisis situation, all or nothing, all your values, what's important for you suddenly comes without your thinking even about it. Suddenly I find New York is my city. America is my country. And my family is, of course, my family. And all of those are in danger. And that had tremendous impact on me.
How so?
Well, I was moved because, I did not want to be once again a wanderer. I had found home. That's why the title, The Road to Home, I was coming home.
Did you realize at the time that you set out to write about your life that that really was the theme?
No. As a matter of fact, the editor and I had big fights over it. She wanted to have it as an immigrant's tale. I said no. I want to have only with the kindness of strangers. She said no. Till I wrote the postscript for the book coming from Michigan. Then we found out that we agreed The Road to Home.
Connection listeners, we're talking this hour with Vartan Gregorian about his life. Unlike many immigrants, he did not feel so homesick for where he had come from, but the discovery of home was an important one for him. We're talking about the road to home for all of us. Is it really where you come from, or is it where you're going? Is it the place where you carve out the kind of life that you want to live? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be back in just a minute after a break. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection on NPR. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, changes in Iraq. Paul Bremer, a new U.S. civilian administrator, is taking... I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. My guest this hour is Vartan Gregorian, and we're talking about his road from a boyhood of poverty in the Armenian quarter of Tabriz in Iran all the way to the paneled boardrooms of the Carnegie Corporation. We invite you to join us at 1-800-423-8255. And I want to ask what it would be like for someone, a young man like yourself, coming from Iran today. Could he or she, a young woman, duplicate your progress?
I think it would be harder because of after 9/11. Even Iranians living in this country as American citizens face some difficulties when you come to the airport. The very fact that you're born in Iran makes people pause and see. Well, that's normal. In 1979, when I was provost of the University of Pennsylvania, when Khomeini revolution occurred, 78-79, all Iranian citizens, students, were asked to go and register in immigration offices. That was necessary, I knew. But I did not want to impose indignity on them. It's not what you do, but how you do it. So I asked immigration officers to come to University of Pennsylvania, and they registered them in the privacy and so forth in order to protect their dignity and their freedom. Also loaned to them, students, because money had stopped coming from Iran, almost $400,000 loans, which they were repaid. Because one of the great attributes of America is how it behaves during times of crisis, how you deal with intolerance, how you deal with dissent. That's what freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, dignity of citizens, dignity of immigrants have to be protected. So it's not just registration, the manner in which one does it. And that's one of the things I think is difficult now, because to line up in front of immigration offices and so forth, and then to be arrested after having gone there, some of them, rather than to say, all right, since everybody in the current administration is in faith-based, think, why not local churches, local synagogues, local mosques, or local libraries, to have some places where you go and you don't have to be paraded as guilty or potentially guilty and so forth. And that's one of the things I've spoken about. And President Bush has spoken that the enemy have been terrorists, not Muslims, not Middle Easterners and so forth, and should not generalize. But it has not sunk deep on people who think somebody from Middle East therefore must be terrorist or potential terrorist or anti-American and so forth. Their greatest Iranian community is in Los Angeles in America. You have more Iranian doctors in the United States than Iran, more scientists and so forth, all of them contributing to the economy of Iran, and all diverse community, Democrats, Republicans, and so forth. So they have to see immigrants. This is a nation of immigrants. And it's once in a while when crisis comes, it's tested. But how we deal with it is important. Again, it's not the matter how you register or not, but what kind of dignity, what kind of freedom, what kind of sensitivity you show to show that we value all the immigrants who come here.
And so what's your grade? I mean, how well is the fabric holding, if I can completely mix metaphors here?
Well, fabric is holding those who are here, but those who want to come in. It's very difficult because America's greatest power, in my opinion, is not its military power. It's not its economy alone. It's education system. People forget that. Out of two-thirds of world's students studying abroad, entire world, even America, there are more People's Republic of China students in the United States, more Chinese students here than any other foreign group. All the Russian and East European reformists, most of them were former Fulbright scholars or former IREX scholars and others. So America's greatness in through its education system is ideas, contacts, the liberty people witness. It comes with at a cost, but at the same time, that's the greatest power we have, the power of ideas, power of education, and power of showing that we're a nation of nations. We're the microcosm of humanity, that this land, you're treated as an individual, not as a category. Because categorization is sinful in many ways, or dangerous, because you expect everyone to perform according to the norms you have established. And this country was just not established. But as a matter of fact, the term individualism was coined by Alexis de Tocqueville to describe the American character for that very reason.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Judith is phoning in from Boston. Hi, Judith.
Hi. May I speak with Dr. Grigorian?
He's right here. We're both listening.
I'm so appreciative of what you're saying and so appreciative of your wisdom and, above all, of your humor. I remember reading in the New Yorker magazine a profile of you many years back, I guess, when you were at the New York Public Library, and you told a story about your father-in-law when you came to marry your wife, and your father-in-law, who was a member of a relatively aristocratic American family. Do you know the story to which I'm referring?
Yes, I know the story.
Would you tell that story again? Because that story is a lesson in dignity that I have never forgotten.
Well, it was not my father-in-law, actually. My father-in-law is a great lawyer, Henry Emanuel Russell, and my mother-in-law, Faye Russell. They were absolutely wonderful towards me. But I was taken to meet the family's patriarch, my wife's maternal grandfather, who was at that time age 87, and he died later 103. And he was he had done his study in order to know who Armenians are. So he said, in our family Bible of three centuries, there is no foreign name. And I said, Mr. Rattenberry, in Armenian Bible of 16 centuries, there is no foreign name either. And we became good friends. That's the story I think you're referring to. Because people forget that America is young, and every nationality, ethnic group who comes brings thousands of years of their experience as part of the bank to bring to the banquet table of America. And my grandfather, my wife's grandfather, became very fond of me. And but my in-laws, Mr. and Mrs. Russell, adopted me as their child, and they were wonderful to me.
I'm sure of that. I knew them and loved them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Judith. You know, it is interesting that it seems as if you came to the country with the wonderful passport of an Armenian name, which got you from person to person to person to person, many of whom befriended you and really took you under their wing. Now, is that something that is unique to the ethnic experience? Is that Armenians only?
No, no. I found when I was when I came at first, I thought Armenian diaspora, Armenian communities, United States, elsewhere, must be very parochial. But I found they're not. There are many more ethnic publications in New York than English publications, for example. Diasporas serve as stations of acculturation. I came, first time I came to America, I stayed in the home of laundry director of Taft Hotel. I never met him. Stayed 3-4 days in his home. In San Francisco, likewise, and so forth. They took me to, in New York, to my first picnic in Asbury Park in New Jersey, for example. Perfect strangers, but Armenians. So the same thing is for Jews, Chinese, and others. You have an island here, a base from which then you enter in America. It's a safety net. Things go wrong, they will take care of you for the moment. And that's what happened. Second thing that helped me very much, people did not want me to disappoint it, because I had idealized notion of America. It's a land of justice, freedom, equality, and so forth, everything. So nobody wants to say, listen, that's ideal. The reality is this. Because even once I tried, somebody said, don't you dare to be a cynic. A cynic told me, you don't dare to be a cynic. Keep your ideals. So they helped me also to sustain my idealism about possibilities and potentialities of America rather than its limitations.
Let's hear from Mike, who's calling in from St. Louis. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Glad to have this program. I'm a naturalized citizen, although I'm 56. I was about 2 years old when I came over. So I've grown up here. But I've always had a sense, particularly after I'd traveled abroad, that what is so wonderful about this country is the sense of freedom from fear, that sense of presumption of innocence that when you go to almost any other foreign country, you have a sense of angst compared to this country. There's such a tremendous sense of freedom in this country, and it's hard to explain unless you sort of feel it viscerally, but I've always, whenever I talk to people about this country, I mention that.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Mike.
Thank you.
Have you felt that as well, Bert?
Yes, that's as a matter of fact. I write about that in my citizenship section in my book, because when I addressed to 77 nationals who became citizens of America, I mentioned that. But also, I received my first, I will add another point, I received my first lesson in democracy in Omaha, Nebraska, when I was driving to New York from California. I went to a Howard Johnson or one of the restaurants, and I looked back, there was a colonel, United States Army colonel, standing behind me. So automatically I said, please, sir, go ahead of me, because that's normal in the Middle East and elsewhere, Europe and so forth. He said, no, there's a line there. And I've never forgotten that. So it's not only just freedom, but also the notion that law is sovereign and everybody is entitled to justice and equity.
And the notion that everyone is equal when you're standing
equal
in line.
That was
the ideal at any rate.
But I told when I was in Soviet Union in 1966, they couldn't believe that I could leave California, go to New York without a visa from state of California. And when I said I don't need it, with this laughter, they thought I was just not telling the truth.
If you were to try to describe America to your grandmother, what would you say?
I tried once. I said, you know, when there's light in Tabriz, there's darkness in America, vice versa. She thought I was pulling her leg. But not one of those said only good things happen in America. But I would have said that without America, I would not have received my I'm the first one in my family to be university graduate. That the idea that one day I would obtain a PhD, takes in six American universities, be first foreign-born president, provost of University of Pennsylvania, second foreign-born. The first one was imported by Benjamin Franklin, William Smith. First foreign-born president of New York Public Library. One of a handful of foreign-born presidents of Ivy League universities. And that one day I would dance with the Queen of Iran in New York, she would have said, what kind of, what are you smoking? Because she would not even know by then about marijuana. But what are you smoking? Are you dreaming? And I told this to the Queen of Iran. I said, if my grandmother was alive, as I was dancing with her, she invited me to dance with her, by the way. I said, if my grandmother was alive, she would say, hey, you, little Vartan, what are you doing dancing with Queen of Iran? And she said, if my grandmother was alive, she would say the same thing.
I'm sure she would have. Well, this has been such a pleasure spending some time with you. It's really been so much fun to hear your stories and reflect on your life. Do you have one quick, you just mentioned one. I wonder if there is another great, if they could see me now moment.
Well, not exactly, because my attitude has not changed. Only time that I felt if they could see me now was when I was addressing a commencement address, giving a commencement address. And I paused in the middle. I said, where am I? What am I doing? It's just impossible for me to be giving commencement address. And that was marvelous.
Well, thanks so much for sharing so many good stories from your life.
Thank you for having me.
Vartan Gregorian is president of the Carnegie Foundation of New York and author of a new autobiography, The Road to Home, My Life and Times. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation in the forum section of our website, theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Vartan Gregorian discusses his new autobiography, The Road to Home, today at 4 o'clock at the Boston University School of Management. For more information, go to WBUR.org. This is WBUR. Here and Now is up next at noon. We're funded by you, our listeners, also by Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, offering an interdisciplinary doctoral